I just love what you do for me. You're so reliable, smart, and incredibly well-connected.
Excuse me, could I pay for my meal?
Oh, of course. Just having a moment with my CommBank smart terminal. Tap away.
Feel a stronger connection. With extra connectivity, you're always payment ready. There's more to love with the CommBank smart terminal.
It is a nice terminal.
Eligibility criteria, fees and T's and C's apply.
Hey, welcome to the MediCubes podcast, where we bring you all that's good, exciting and sometimes challenging in primary healthcare.
I'm Chris Spee, joined by my good friends Kim Poyner and Rivka Hagen. Together we bring a wealth of experience and passion, as well as being in the thick of what's going on in our industry.
We used to have a laugh, debrief and chat about all the big issues and what was happening in our own professional worlds, and invite you to join us in this conversation.
So join us and our invited guests every month to bring you a lighthearted take on the latest, greatest and controversial issues and a few pearls of wisdom along the way.
In the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we meet and pay our respects to the elders past, present and emerging. A hearty welcome from Birrarri country.
And Rivka Hagen here. I'm meeting you from Jajawurrung country.
And a big hello from Turrbal and Jagera country.
Hi, everyone. It is great to bring you yet another episode of the MediCubes podcast. And today I'm joined by Kim Poyner, as always. Chris is missing today. He is not part of the panel, but we are so excited to bring our very good friend and colleague, Dr. Tony Lemke, to the podcast to nabber about all things quality improvement. So let me tell you a little bit about Tony. Tony is a GP in Alstonville in northern New South Wales, and he was the clinical director of the Australian Primary Care Collaboratives that some of you who have been around a little bit longer may well remember his pivotal role within that organisation, where he led the quality improvement in general practice role over many years. And through that work, he has worked in more than 1,000 general practices. And I guess I'm just going to throw in a little anecdote there to say that I've been, you know, sort of fangirling Tony Lemke for the longest time because I was a young, naive practice manager when I first intersected with the primary care collaboratives. And I was just so influenced by the work that Tony brought forward, and it has absolutely informed my understanding and intersection with quality improvement for the longest time now. So I am so excited to have Tony come along to have a bit of a chatter with us. So Kim, any thoughts from you as we kick off this conversation?
Yeah, I'm excited to have my friend and colleague Tony Lemke here as well. You know, we have had so many times together, and I just find that when Tony's speaking about quality improvement, you just see that passion shine through. So from my perspective, I first want to kick off with what Tony's fun fact is. Like, let's hear what Tony's got to share with us, because there's always something random and fun that Tony gets to share always with Rivka and I particularly.
Yes, good morning, Kiv, and good morning, Riff. And it's a great pleasure to be here today with you and your podcast listeners. And Riff, now you're a very young but wiser practice manager. So how good is that? My fun fact that people may not know is that I'm a amateur magician. So my favorite thing at work is, once the medicine's done, to challenge my patients with a magic trick, which is always great fun. Started with the kids, and now we do it with everybody.
Yeah, and we tried to get you to do that when we had our quality improvement day, just as an icebreaker, and you declined. So I'm looking forward to maybe I have to turn up as a patient to your practice to actually experience this magic show. But before we kick off, let's just find out from you particularly, can you explain to people who are probably new to quality improvement, as Rivka and I said, you know, we've known quality improvement from the collaborative days, but for the new people, you know, to primary care, what actually is quality improvement? People think it's just PDSAs. So when we're talking about quality improvement in healthcare, what does it seek to achieve, Tony?
Well, I think it's important to remember, Kim, that quality improvement, and we'll talk about this in the podcast, it's simple, it's got to be practical, it's a normal thing to do, and it should be a fun thing to do. That's our basic understanding of what quality improvement can be. So we all want to do work that matters for people that care. And so quality improvement is the science and the art of making things better. I guess it's science because it's based on the principles of the scientific method of trial and learning. And it's art because we're dealing with people. There's change management of people and their personalities involved. I guess from the practice's point of view, it helps us achieve three of the major aims of the practices. One is for patients who want to deliver better care, better health outcomes and better experience of care for patients. For providers, we want to make it easier for them to deliver the high level care that they aspire to deliver. And for the practice, we want to achieve a better bottom line, a more sustainable practice. So I think quality improvement is a tool that can enable us to achieve those three aims.
Lofty goals, you know, high ambitions. And you explain that just so cleanly and clearly, Tony. And, you know, with those words, it would be hard to imagine anyone not going, that is absolutely what we want to achieve within our teams, and that sense of an ongoing journey there as well. Can you outline a bit of an example of where quality improvement has led to a tangible benefit? Can you just throw some life into some practical examples of how that might apply?
Yeah, sure, Ruth. So in the collaboratives, when we worked on those, we had the opportunity to work with hundreds or about 1,000 practices across Australia. And I was always amazed at the excellent improvement ideas that they were able to implement in their practices once they had the culture of quality improvement. So some of the things that we saw coming out of that, most importantly, proactive nurse-led chronic disease management clinics, which listeners to your podcast no doubt will be familiar with. They developed systematic approaches to identifying patients, for example, with coronary artery disease and ensuring that they're on their evidence-based treatment. We know that, for example, being on a statin reduces your risk of a heart attack by a third, and yet many of our patients at high risk, we knew their names, addresses, phone numbers, but they weren't on a statin. So by being systematic and proactive in managing the patients, we were able to improve their health outcomes. It's been used, for example, to decrease interruptions for doctors and give certainty for nurses, providing them with tools to signal to the doctor that they're ready for their come to their rooms instead of nurses having to wait in the corridor for the doctor to poke his head out of the room and nab them at the time. Practices have implemented new processes for ensuring patients have access to repeat prescriptions that doesn't interrupt the workflow, that's done proactively, new procedures for handling telephone calls, for handing out results, new systems to help doctors run to time so there's some truth in advertising about appointment time. So wherever your problem is in your practice, you can use a quality improvement approach to try and remedy that.
Tony, I just heard you refer to the culture of quality improvement. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yes. I think that once quality improvement is seen as a normal business in your practice, that you have this culture that the Japanese called Kaizen, of falling forwards, of always seeking to improve. Practices where the people who work in their practices have permission to try new things, to identify problems, and then to try and implement steps that may improve their work, I think they're the practices that are most successful. And it used to be in our practice before we were involved in the collaboratives that it was a federal case to change anything. We did things the way we do it in this practice because that's the way we've always done it. To change anything required demonstrating that the things wouldn't be worse completely. It involved numerous meetings to plan out every possible commutation of outcomes. And so once we got into the collaborative process, understood a bit more about quality improvement, had a risk-free approach to making change, we developed that culture of where something wasn't working well, we would look to improvement. Even when things were working well, we'd look to ways we could try and do that better.
Yeah, it sounds like that's that psychological safety within your team that I can try things, I can admit when things don't go quite right, and I'm able to safely say in an environment, and as you said, Rivka, it's a culture, that I can freely say this is not working, this is not the way and approach that we should keep going, rather than, you know, some people just think, well, that's not my decision to make, I can't speak freely about that. So having really a flat hierarchy versus having that typical hierarchical structure where people at maybe the coalface who are delivering this quality improvement initiative couldn't feel like that they had any decision or choice in the matter. So I really love that you're providing that safety within your team to say something.
I think part of that culture, Kim, as you say, is that by saying that something could be improved doesn't mean that we've made a mistake in the way we're doing it now.
Yeah.
So that when someone suggests an improvement, it's not taken as a criticism to the management or to the person that they're doing something wrong. And I see that all the time, that people are very defensive when someone suggests a new way of doing things. So part of that culture is that understanding that it's not a criticism to say that things could be better.
Yeah, and really taking it on board, isn't it, from that growth perspective of I gain more, or our patient gains more, or our team gains more, if someone actually has the safety in the environment to say, hey, should we give this a go? And instead of thinking, well, I'm going to hurt someone's feelings, or someone's going to be defensive, or someone's going to leave the workforce, we don't want to cultivate that. We absolutely want to come through with everyone seeing it as an opportunity and something to just test drive. Now, Tony, when we think about what we've adopted in quality improvement healthcare, the model of improvement's been the model of choice. Can you talk about how that model came to be that particular model of choice?
Sure, Kim. So quality improvement as a science was developed to fulfill the needs of industry over the last century. And there were pioneers in the field, such as Joseph Juran and W. Edward Deming, and they introduced statistical and scientific methodology to management. So both were engineers. They've both been recognized as being instrumental in leading the magnificent post-war recovery effort in Japan and the enormously successful industrialization that took place there. And it evolves from Deming's system of profound knowledge, was adapted in the 1980s by a group called Associates in Process Improvement, the book The Improvement Guide, 1996. And that model for improvement was seen as a simple and accessible framework, and was taken up by the quality movement in healthcare, particularly the IHI, which is the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, which is a US organization that's been instrumental in driving most of the quality improvement methodology that's been taken up in healthcare all around the world, particularly in England and in Australia, where it was introduced in a systematic way in about 2004 as part of their APCC program, the Australian Primary Care Collaborative Program, and that ran until 2014. So in all, about 1,800 practices across Australia participated in that quality improvement program over those 10-year period, and they were all trained in the model for improvement as it was adapted from Deming and Juran and the pioneers of the field, both through management and business and then into healthcare.
So, Tony, for the practices who are newer to this whole sort of, you know, QI methodology, what are your tips and hints to making the implementation of QI within the workplace? You know, where do practices kind of start on this journey?
Well, I think as a general principle, we see quality improvement as a process of trial and learning. So, and there are two components that practices should remember, part of the implementation of quality improvement. The first is the thinking part, Riff. So, most important. So, we think it's a mechanism for planning our quality improvement processes. And there's three fundamental questions that we ask ourselves when we have a problem or an issue that we're trying to improve. And the questions are, what are we trying to accomplish? So, having a clear picture and an aim of what we're trying to achieve by embarking on this endeavor. Question two, how will we know that a change is an improvement? So not all change leads to improvement. How will we recognize that the activities that we've taken have actually led to better outcomes? And three, what ideas can we put to the test that may lead to an improvement? Okay. So they're the three questions that we adopt in the planning stage, and they help our teams develop some clear aims, perhaps some measures that they can use, some data they can use to demonstrate that they're achieving improvement, and will help them develop the change ideas that they need to embark on their improvement efforts. And we want to develop these improvement ideas. I think that's the aim of the thinking section. An improvement idea can be encapsulated by saying, I will improve X by doing Y. I will improve our running on time by monitoring doctor's starting times or whatever it is. I think that's the formula for an improvement idea which comes out of the thinking part.
Okay, excellent. Tony, thanks for that. You've really articulated the thinking part of the QI model for improvement. And you also referred to the doing part. Can you put some flesh around that for us?
Yes, Riff. So the doing part is the mechanism of putting into action the improvement ideas that we've developed. And this is straightforward. So it's a series of steps that test out and then implement our improvement ideas. And this process is iterative. So each step should be small, especially the first step. Small steps, try it out, see if it works. The question you might ask yourself, what will I do? And then what did I do? And then what did I learn? And then do the next step. The major problem I see with practices in the doing part is trying to do too much in one step. And by doing small steps, that provides a safety component of doing quality improvement work. They're undoable. It's not going to be a great risk.
Yeah, excellent. And so you're really kind of referring to that notion of chunking down the activity components so that you can land on an action that is really clearly identified and understood. So the smaller those steps are, the more confident we can be that we know what we're doing, we know what's ahead of us, and therefore the likelihood of success coming out of that is increased. What we do hear about still quite frequently from practices as far as their QI journey is concerned is that they get a little bit of that heart sink to say, oh, it's yet another thing to do and another burden that we need to envelop into our day. How can we challenge some of those sentiments and how can we take the sting out of this work?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question, Riff. And we want to remember that it should be an easy process to implement. The only thing that worse than systematically improving the work that you do is not improving the work that you do. We really don't have a choice as far as needing to do things better if we're going to deliver the sort of care in a changing environment. We need to be attuned to the needs to continually improve the work. So there's some steps, I think, some improvement rules that practices that are successful, I think, have adopted to help them make it less of a chore and to make it be more effective for them. And I might run through those steps. Number one is to focus north. So we learned from our pioneers that quality is measured from the patient's point of view. So if you focus at each implementation on how does this make things better for the patient, what difference does it make to their health outcomes and their experience of delivering care? That's where the real gold star is. That's where the real work happens. So we focus north. Number two is to think in systems rather than in people. So every system we say is perfectly designed to achieve exactly the results it gets. If you want a different result in your practice, you need to change your systems for delivering care. So it's not about blaming the receptionist on Monday when people are double booked and it's very busy and blaming the patients on Monday when they all ring up on that Monday. Don't they know it's busy on Mondays? But if this is the same result you're getting every Monday forever, think about your systems for organising appointments on Monday. So think about the systems, not blaming the people. Number three is to measure. So Deming used to say, in God we trust, all others bring data. So remembering, however, that many important things that must be managed, you can't measure them. But there are lots of different things we could talk about in measurement and how you do that and how you make it workable for your practice. And most importantly, I think, to start with one. So if someone comes up with an idea, I think this would be a good idea if we managed wounds in this different way. You know, we had a different appointment system for wounds. That's a good idea. Test it out on one patient. Let me know how it goes. So it's not a whole of practice change in one step, but we start with one provider, one patient on one occasion and test it out and learn from that. And then we can iterate on that and do another step. So remember, keep your test steps small and start with one. We should still shamelessly. So general practice is very unaware of what other practices are doing in my experience. So if something's being done well in Townsville, I want it to be done well in Austinville as well. Knowing the implementation is different in every single practice because we've got different personnel and different resources and different patients and different skills. But still, we can learn from other practices if we choose to do so. So we should share generously and still shamelessly. And the final step is that culture we talked about of falling forwards, that Kaizen, where change is inevitable, but improvement is optional. So we want to make this process for ourselves and for our staff joyous and easy and natural and bring out our curious scientists that we all are. That's an interesting idea. Test it out and let us know how it goes. That should be the answer when somebody comes up with a new idea, not, no, we don't do it that way around here, or bring it up at the next meeting, or we want to have that culture in our practice, that everyone has that job of improving the work that they do.
Great. And, you know, I think moving forward, if we look at the 10-year plan and we look at things such as My Medicare developments that are going to maybe change, you know, over the next few years, and there's going to be different buckets of funding and there's going to be different models of care that's going to be delivered. I would love to think about how do we get those more experienced practices to start to be a bit more innovative and creative. You know, they've run out of the streamlining of what their workflows are currently, but how do you get those, you know, ideation and innovation models of care happening, Tony?
Kim, I guess as far as sharing ambitious endeavours or sharing new endeavours or sharing new initiatives between practices, we used to have run little Kaizen meetings in our area where we'd come together and each practice would take it in turns to, in a very simple way, talk about the things that they've been doing. And it was revolutionary and lovely. So the practice managers and the doctors and nurses who attended really enjoyed those meetings. They weren't about a clinical issue. They were about system change and quite different from the other meetings that we all attend. I don't know why they've fallen away. There seems to be a culture of if something's working really well, we should stop doing it immediately. And so I think we can, as individual practices in our area, perhaps reintroduce these Kaizen meetings, perhaps with the support of your local PHM would be happy to do that. Perhaps you've got, you travel more than I do now, Kim and Riff, perhaps you've got more experiences in how practices can share.
Yeah, I've actually just had an exact circumstance of this. The CVC program, they removed the education module off the Department of Veteran Affairs, and a lot of nurses have retired, and that's succession planning, and we've got some young blood and it's enthusiasm to take on the CVC program. But they're finding that it's really quite difficult to find the education to support there. There's still the toolkit there. So across the footprint where I've been traveling recently, I've heard, oh, I've been doing it for a couple of years. Oh, I've just started. I'm doing little bits of this and I'm doing little bits of that. So I've actually formalised a little bit with the PHN and their practice team, the support team there, to bring those nurses together to kind of go, well, what do you know locally that they can access in terms of supporting their veteran affairs clients? Because there's little patches of people going, well, I know a bit about it. I know a lot about it. I know nothing about it. So let's actually sit down together and share those ideas, because it's going to be better for the patients. There's no doubt about it. So, yeah, I see that there's little bits everywhere of things happening. So pulling them together is going to be so much more useful in a community of practice way.
Yeah. And look, you know, I guess similarly too, but on a slightly different scale, I regularly intersect with especially practice managers from across the country, bringing them together for sort of monthly Q&A sessions, which are very much driven around what are you curious about this month, what's worrying you, and also what's working really well, what have been your wins and your gains that you would like to share with your colleagues. And that cross-fertilization of knowledge and skill and understanding, as well as reflecting back that the bits that we're finding hard are kind of universally hard. So that sense of breaking down the isolation of that role is a real benefit out of that as well. So, you know, in a roundabout way, that absolutely supports that that QI journey as well.
Yes, I think that's right. I think the collaboratives program, the formal program, showed us the joy of collaborative learning. I think what practices most enjoyed about that was getting together with like-minded peers, thinking about the way they do things. And so even though that formal program is closed, it doesn't stop us from individually implementing collaborative learning opportunities in our regions. And we should look out for those if they become available.
Oh, Tony, I've just been at the New South Wales RDN conference. And, you know, I was just speaking about lifestyle medicine in general practice. And I have met out of the crowd people that are doing incredible things that I had no idea that they were doing. So in Coordinaire, there's a fabulous initiative whereby they're doing some lifestyle medicine around obesity strategies, but now they're going to move into chronic pain. So they were talking about their model of care, the systems, the processes, the outcomes for the patients. Not only that, they were talking about the providers, what they get out of it. I love that people were telling me about what they were doing and how they were going about it. Another particular practice in terms of their preventative activities, they were looking at having an endometriosis clinic. So they were running group programs and education for the women in their clinic in Milton. So I'm just hearing about this incredible work that's been done, but there's nothing like a conference where people are sharing and networking and hearing about these incredible models of care that just don't necessarily get the airtime they deserve.
That's absolutely right. Nearly every practice I've visited is doing something that I think is extraordinary, and they don't appreciate the fact of how special they are. So we all have things that we can share, and we can all have things that we can learn from other practices. So we look for opportunities to bring practices together.
Fantastic. Well, what an interesting conversation. It is absolutely one of my favourite topics always. Tony, do you have any final messages or takeaway key ideas or tips for our audience?
I think, Riff, if they adopt that culture of Kaizen, of falling forwards, of continuous quality improvement in their practices, but make it easy to do. So don't get caught up in some of the terminology.
Yeah.
But what are we trying to change? We'll improve X by doing Y. What are the steps that might take us to where we want to go? You can drive 100 kilometres even though your headlights at nighttime can only see 100 metres ahead on the road. So you don't need to have it all graphed out. You can just start and then keep going. And who knows, you'll end up like some of the terrific practices that Kim's been talking about. So good luck, everybody.
Beautiful imagery right there. I love that. Kim, any last thoughts from you?
No, it's always a joy just to hear your words of wisdom, Tony. And, you know, I love that quality improvement since 2014 may have just sat on the back boiler for a little while there, but now is starting to really get the airtime it deserves. It's getting the exposure it deserves, and I can't wait to see the great things that people do as a result of getting quality improvement back into their workflows on a daily basis.
Thank you very much for speaking with me today. It's been lovely.
Thanks for listening to the Medicubes podcast. Make sure you subscribe via your favourite podcast listening app so you don't miss an episode. Medicubes is brought to you by Cubico, MediCoach and Medical Business Services, with technical support from the awesome crew at Talking Health Tech. This podcast presents information of a general nature, and we recommend that you obtain professional advice for your individual circumstances always. We'd love to hear your feedback, questions, and suggestions for future topics on the show. Make sure you visit us via the Medicubes website, which you can access via the show notes of this episode. Also, if you're enjoying the show, write us a nice review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and share it with someone who might get some value from it, so we can continue to share these important messages with more people. Speak to you next time.